Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And we're really very pleased to have as our guest, Zafar Bengash, Crescent International. Zafar has been our guest in the past. He's one of the true authorities on Islam and on the politics of the region that we want to talk about, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, and of course, this new story of the victory in Afghanistan of the Taliban, and which has every newspaper editor tearing his hair out trying to pick out which bad thing to say about Afghanistan. Zafar, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Phil. It's my pleasure to be with you again.
If you don't mind, we'll start with some of the headlines, because people have been looking at the television and their papers, and the Taliban has established itself. A new government is coming into being. People seem to forget that until only about a month ago, there was a war going on, and you have a kind of confused situation, which anyone would expect to have. As new leaders emerge and they assume power in a country, it's 38 million people. But the press here immediately goes to work on subjects like, well, protests have been broken up, and they stress by women, although there have been, I understand, various kinds of protests. I wouldn't expect to see protests treated happily by a new government anywhere in the world if it's come to power by either revolution or war. The second story is that is getting a lot of coverage, and with a twist on it, is the one of education. We spoke to you previously about, well, is this going to be the old Taliban or is it something new? And my understanding is the new is that they've already said that women, unlike in the past Taliban, are going to be be educated in higher education. But the media here says, oh, well, it's going to be segregated. Could you comment on those two stories? First of all, is it any surprise that protests are not met happily? I haven't noticed, by the way, anybody was killed in over these protests.
Yes, well, as you rightly pointed out, these two narratives have dominated news headlines, and one protest, especially by women, and secondly, about this concern for women's education. First of all, let's look at these protests. These occurred in Kabul, a very small number of women, and it was, in fact, it is understandable because foreign or Western interference in Afghanistan over the last 20 years only affected in a positive way, if we want to look at it, the people in major cities. And there are very few of them, actually, in Afghanistan. Kabul, of course, is the largest city with 6 million people. And so it's not surprising that there would be women that have achieved education and some degree of success in various fields. And with the Taliban coming to power, perhaps they felt that their rights to education, et cetera, would be curtailed. Their assumption, of course, was judging the Taliban from their past performance back in 1996 to 2001. But the Taliban today are very different from the one 20, 25 years ago. They have not shut down any schools. They have not shut down universities. All they have said is that women should dress appropriately according to the cultural sensitivities of the majority of the population. And there have been, in fact, other demonstrations that unfortunately have not been reported in the Western media. And these are of women in support of the Taliban. They are saying to these westernized women that you don't speak for us. They have in fact issued a statement. These women that were holding a demonstration in support of the Taliban, they said that we have been liberated, our country has been liberated, and we are now able to go about unmolested by the thugs that constituted the former police of the US-backed regime, that now we don't have warlords molesting us, that we have considerable peace and security in our country. And they also issued a statement that these Afghan women that have fled Afghanistan and are now in the West, they don't speak on our behalf. This is information, unfortunately, that you don't hear or you don't read in the Western media. You don't see it on Western televisions. And they wouldn't go and interview these women to see what they have to say. So we are only getting a very, very narrow perspective of the reality in Afghanistan. I would also like to draw the attention of your listeners to two other news items. It was interesting. One was a very good piece in the New Yorker magazine on September the 6th. And the New Yorker reporter, Anand Gopal, he actually went into the rural areas of Afghanistan to talk to the rural population where 70% of the Afghans live. And he said that to his great surprise, the overwhelming majority of the rural population in Afghanistan support the Taliban. They supported the Taliban because they saw the foreign military forces as well as their Afghan allies as violating their rights, as breaking down their doors, entering into their homes, threatening women at gunpoint, killing children. And these rural areas fully supported the Taliban because the Taliban came and told them, these are foreigners, they are trampling on our rights, they have no business being here, they have no business violating the honor of our women folk whose homes are being raided and invaded. The other piece that I'd like to draw your listeners' attention to is that on September the 8th at on TVO, right here in Toronto, Graham Smith's documentary, The Ghosts of Afghanistan, was shown. It's almost a two-hour documentary. And Graham Smith used to be a correspondent for the Globe and Mail back in the from 2001 to 2010. At that time, he openly admits in his documentary that I was not very familiar with the situation in Afghanistan, and I simply went with the foreign forces and reported what they were telling me. But he said that when I went into the rural areas, I found a very different situation. And he has actually reported very fairly. I mean, he has covered both sides, both the people that served in the US-backed regime, as well as Taliban representatives, as well as people in the rural areas. And he has drawn up a much broader picture of the reality in Afghanistan, in which he says that basically the foreign presence in Afghanistan was not to the benefit of the Afghan people. It benefited only a tiny minority of people, but not the majority. I want to just mention two other quick points, and that is that on the one hand, we keep on hearing about, the Western reports, media reports say, well, we have heard reports that the Taliban have gone to people's homes and they are killing people and targeting, etc. They don't say what the sources of these reports are, yet they just mention that we have heard reports. And then the second thing is there is a great deal of vilification of Pakistan as well. I'm not here to sort of apologize for the Pakistani government, but in all fairness, I think Pakistan has done more than its share to help the people of Afghanistan. It's the only country in the region that is serving as a land bridge for humanitarian aid to Afghanistan. Many European countries have blocked PIA planes from landing because they say that these planes are not properly serviced, they are not safe, etc., etc. And yet these same Western governments urged Pakistan and the PIA to bring their nationals out of Kabul into Pakistan and host them until they can be taken to Western countries. And these are of those Afghans that collaborated with the Western occupation. So these are collaborators. So, you know, here is Pakistan constantly being blamed for, you know, somehow manipulating the situation in Afghanistan. And yet at the same time, the US, Britain, France, Germany, Spain, Australia, everybody is telling Pakistan, please help us to get our nationals out of Afghanistan. So, or people holding visas, et cetera. And I think it's time that this blame game stops. I think the West, particularly the US, should recognize that it lost the war in Afghanistan because it never cared for the people of Afghanistan. I mean, you cannot have a guerrilla insurgency managing for 20 years if it did not enjoy the support of the people. And the vast majority of the Afghans saw the US-backed and installed regime as corrupt, as oppressive, as, you know, people that didn't cater to the needs of the people, whereas the Taliban did. And I think we need to give the Taliban the credit that they deserve, whether we agree with their ideology or not, but at least they are looking after the people of Afghanistan. They are not exploiting them.
Yeah. Well, they had sufficient support of the people that they brushed the so-called government away very quickly as once the Americans packed up. We're speaking to Zafar Benghazi, Crescent International, and Zafar is himself from Pakistan and, of course, has been writing about this matter, the region for years. And Zafar, we're talking about, you know, the whole region has changed, actually, has it not? I mean, this is not the same Pakistan government of 25 years ago.
You are absolutely right. In fact, the earlier governments in Pakistan did not play a role that the vast majority of the people in Pakistan supported. In particular, General Pervez Musharraf, who was a military dictator, who obviously needed to legitimize his rule in Pakistan, so he immediately surrendered to US demands to join the US war on Afghanistan. But the government that is in power now, that of Prime Minister Imran Khan, he had right from the beginning opposed the war on Afghanistan. He had maintained that there is no military solution to the problem in Afghanistan, that there has to be a political solution, there has to be dialogue. And he was accused of being pro-Taliban. He was even named Taliban Khan. And you know, a few months ago in the National Assembly of Pakistan, he gave a very impassioned speech in which he said that I was accused of all kinds of things. And now we see that whatever I had stood for to say that there has to be a dialogue with the Taliban, that they are the representative of the Afghan people. Now everybody has come to that recognition. So as you pointed out, yes, the government in Pakistan today is very different from the one that was there 20, 25 years ago. And unfortunately, as a consequence of that policy or the failed policies of the previous governments in Pakistan, Pakistan had to pay a very, very heavy price. In this so-called war on terror that Pakistan supported with the US, Pakistan lost more than 70,000 of its own people over the last 20 years, because of the fact that there were acts of terrorism from Afghanistan being conducted into Pakistan, American drone attacks on Pakistani territory with the complicity of Pakistani governments. Pakistan lost economic losses to the tune of $170 billion. That's why Pakistan is economically in such a great mess today, because its infrastructure has been destroyed. I was in Pakistan in December of 2019, and I noticed the areas that were devastated, the areas where, you know, the infrastructure, the roads had been destroyed, bridges had been wiped out, railway lines had been, you know, destroyed, areas that were bombed. A lot of mess has been created in Pakistan as a result of this U.S. war on terror and U.S. war on Afghanistan. And of course, even Obama was involved in attacking the tribal areas of Pakistan in drone attacks, where literally tens of thousands of people were killed. I mean, I know the place that I was born in when I went to visit it, not only 2019, but a few years earlier, my own relatives were telling me that, the Pakistan army had set up their big artillery guns here, and every 2 minutes they would fire them in the tribal areas at the behest of the United States. And literally thousands of innocent people were killed over there. And these are Pakistani citizens. But because the Americans wanted that, Pakistan should attack its own citizens, allegedly because, these militants were coming from Afghanistan into the tribal areas, that therefore the Pakistan army was obliged to attack its own people. And this is one of the sad aspects. But fortunately, since the new government came to power in Pakistan in 2019 or 2018, now at least we have a different scenario, a different situation. This government is a lot more in tune with the wishes of the people of Pakistan, and it is working very hard to try to help the people of Afghanistan as well. Because right now, unfortunately, there is a great humanitarian crisis that has erupted in Afghanistan. And this is because this was actually brewing a lot earlier than the Taliban came to power. But now that the US has frozen about $10 billion of Afghanistan's foreign exchange reserves, the World Bank, IMF have all held back from providing funds to Afghanistan, that the World Food Program and the UN have said that there is going to be a humanitarian catastrophe. It doesn't get immediate humanitarian aid.
I just want to make sure I ask you right there. They introduced that language, disaster, humanitarian. But if you read between the lines, it's almost as if that is what they want to happen. Because
exactly.
Where is the world rushing, particularly the Americans, who, as prime party, guilty of creating havoc in Afghanistan? They leave a disaster of their making, and then it's like they're using artillery from abroad by saying, oh, now we're going to keep you from getting the funds that belong to your country.
Exactly. That's exactly what they are doing. Like, as you said, there are two things that they've been talking about. One is that there is going to be a civil war in Afghanistan. They wanted a civil war to erupt. That has not erupted because the Taliban have not gone around on revenge killings. They have not gone around on, killing people over there. In fact, hardly anybody has been killed since the Taliban took over almost a month ago. Secondly, this humanitarian disaster, which had been going on much earlier. Just to give you an example, now we read reports in the newspapers and on television, et cetera, that civil servants in Afghanistan have not been paid their salaries, and they are clamoring that the Taliban should pay their salaries. But these civil servants were not paid their salaries for the last 6 months. The Taliban have only been in power for less than a month. So it's not the Taliban's responsibility. For the previous 5 months, the other regime did not pay these people. Those rulers stole that money. They took hundreds of millions of dollars with them in their planes when they fled the country. And yet it is being presented as if it's the Taliban that are holding people's salaries. And of course, the new government is very short of cash because the US and other foreign agencies have withheld their financial support. Even before the Taliban took over, 40% of the Afghan annual budget came from abroad, 40% of it. And it had to be in the form of financial handouts, et cetera. But most of this money never ended in Afghanistan. It actually went into the pockets of these corrupt government officials. And the $2.26 trillion that the US spent in Afghanistan over the last 20 years, the overwhelming majority of that money went to American contractors, arms manufacturers, generals. This revolving door between the Pentagon and the, you know, lobbyists, etc. I mean, there's a big racket going on, and that is the reason why this whole war on Afghanistan failed, and failed so miserably, because there were thousands of Americans making tons of money out of this war on Afghanistan, and that's why these people didn't want this war to end. And now we are sort of hearing reports that, well, there is a humanitarian crisis, these people have not been paid. But this humanitarian crisis has not been created by the Taliban. It was created by the previous government, by the corruption of that government, in connivance with the Americans. And they are blaming the Taliban for this. But as you said, they want a humanitarian crisis. That's why they're holding this money back from the Taliban. They should be giving this money to the Taliban. They should be providing humanitarian assistance. The UN has said that if this aid is not provided immediately, 90% of the people of Afghanistan are going to fall into poverty by the end of this year. And right today, there is a conference that took place in Geneva. It was a UN-sponsored conference that required, they had asked for $1.3 billion, and they were still $600 million short of aid to Afghanistan immediately. And I still have to, you know, look for the reports and see whether those $600 million have been pledged, or whether they will be given to Afghanistan under the Taliban so that they can address this humanitarian crisis that is about to erupt in Afghanistan.
Again, we're speaking to Zafar Benghash. This is the Taylor Report at CIUT 89.5 FM. And Zafar, there's so much talk. And again, it's the motivation for the talk is striking. It's as though they're trying to establish a pretext for re-engagement. But one aspect of it is the ethnic, and of course, there's also the Islamic matter of it. There's the allegations that, well, the Taliban are tribal, that they are Pashtun, and then there's issues such as relations with other regions, but also with the Shia element. Can you talk about those things?
Yes, absolutely. Let's first of all understand that, Afghanistan is a tribal society. There are a number of ethnicities over there. The predominant group is Pashtun. They are obviously the overwhelming majority of the population, more than 50%. And then you have Tajiks, the second group, which is probably about 20%. Then you have the Hazaras, who are Shias. They're probably another 15 to 20%. And then you have the Uzbeks and Turkmens that constitute the remainder of the 10%, or less than that. So basically, the Taliban do constitute a majority of the population. But what they have done over the years is, unlike the past, that they have now brought into their central committee members of the Tajik ethnic minority, the Uzbeks, the Turkmens, the Hazaras. They have got them in that central committee so that they cannot be accused of only catering to the needs of the Pashtuns. They are in fact saying that we recognize that Afghanistan is a tribal ethnic society, that we have to have the representation of all of these people, and they should be part of the setup. That is why the government that they set up, they are calling it an interim government. It's not the final government, because they had to have some kind of a governing structure to look after the various challenges that they face. And they say that, you know, we are still in discussions with these various groups, and we want to accommodate them and have them represented in the Afghan cabinet. So I'm hoping that would be the case. Just to give you an example, in the in the Panjshir Valley, where there was this so-called rebellion, and these people were claiming that, you know, we are not going to allow Taliban rule and they cannot, you know, overtake Panjshir Valley. The Taliban offered to negotiate with them. They said, look, why don't we talk about this rather than fighting over this? And the people from Panjshir Valley, it's a small area, and regrettably, it still is getting support from the French, the Tajik government just across the border, etc. These people in the Panjshir Valley demanded of the Taliban that you have to give us 1/3 of the cabinet posts in the new government. And among them, they demanded that the president should be from their group, that the foreign minister should be from their group, the interior minister should be from their group, and the finance minister should be from their group. So the Taliban said, we are the ones who fought the foreign occupiers for 20 years, and you want all of these posts, and you represent a tiny minority. How can we do this? And this is the kinds of ridiculous things that are happening. And of course, you know, the Taliban said, okay, if you are, that's how you talk, and that's how your things are, then you're obviously spoiling for a fight, and you will get it. So when the Taliban sort of, you know, entered Panjshir Valley, they have not liberated it completely. The rebel leaders, Ahmad Massoud, the son of that so-called famous Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was a French and American agent, he never fought the Russians either. And Amrullah Saleh, another, you know, Indian agent, they both of them fled to Tajikistan. They left their people over there. So the Panjshir Valley is now completely under the Taliban control. But the Taliban have still said that we want to have an inclusive government. We want to include other people in it. And just give us a time. We just want to make sure that we can bring the situation under proper control, establish proper norms in society, and then we would have these other groups represented in the cabinet. What is interesting and I think encouraging is that they are still holding talks with the former president Hamid Karzai, the former chief executive Abdullah, who's still in Afghanistan, who was basically a partner with the deposed president Ashraf Ghani. Although Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani never got along, because Abdullah always said that Ashraf Ghani has basically rigged the elections to stay in power. But Abdullah did not run away, to his credit. I think, you know, he's afraid of anything. He understands that, you know.
If yes. I could just interrupt there, I mean, you notice that, again, the propaganda war, for a few days, they tried to make out that he was either in prison or dead, or being tortured, and he had to go public and say, no, I'm not been bothered by anybody.
Exactly. Not only that.
That did not make headlines. It would be very helpful if they would acknowledge that Mr. Karzai is talking with and has friendly relations with the Taliban, and everybody should say, well, that is very encouraging.
Exactly. They're not mentioning that. I mean, only a few outlets mentioned that, in fact, once the Taliban had taken over Kabul, that Mr. Abdullah actually called a meeting with the Taliban in his own house. The Taliban representatives came to his house. They sat with him. They talked about the future of Afghanistan, and the Taliban told him that we want all the Afghans to stay in the country. We want them to rebuild this country. We don't want our educated Afghans to leave the country, because we want everybody's input to make Afghanistan a success story once again. And so, Mr. Abdullah is still there. Hamid Karzai is still talking to the Taliban. They have all been welcomed. Even now there are discussions going on. And as you mentioned, that there were rumors about Mr. Abdullah being killed or imprisoned, etc. And even when he issued a statement, nothing, it wasn't publicized. There was another rumor that started a couple of days ago that one of the Taliban leaders, Mullah Baradar, Abdul Ghani Baradar, had been killed in shooting within the Taliban leadership. And he today he had to issue a statement. He said, I'm still alive. Please don't spread these rumors. There is nothing, no truth to it. It's very unfortunate that there are these rumors that are being spread. But unfortunately, there are certain vested interests that would like to create confusion and sow discord in Afghanistan, because they are hoping that somehow a civil war would break out, yes, which it hasn't.
They want to come back.
Exactly.
I know it would be an issue close to your, well, certainly drawing your attention, but I have to remark that the India's media is in a state of hysteria about the situation in Afghanistan. And I'll give you an anecdote I saw. An India broadcaster was speaking to a Taliban spokesperson. And he said, well, if you are patriots and you've got a good government, why is everybody running away? Why the refugees? And the Taliban spokesman said, if the West began to offer visas at the airport in Delhi, he said, you would be swamped.
Absolutely, exactly. In fact, you know, as the Taliban spokesperson pointed out, this is absolutely the case. I mean, even now, if anybody wants to find out exactly, how the Indians react, all they have to do is go and see outside the American embassy in Delhi and see the miles and miles of lines of Indians applying for visas to go to the United States. They can do the same thing outside the Canadian High Commission in Delhi, and they would find there are lines that stretch miles and miles and miles of Indians hoping to get to Canada. The same with Britain. So that Taliban representative was quite right in stating that if the Americans were to announce that, you know, they would take Indians out of New Delhi, I think New Delhi airport would be totally swamped with people rushing to get out. The Indians, unfortunately, have indulged in other nonsensical propaganda. And let me give you two examples. Number one, that when the Taliban were carrying out their operations in Panjshir Valley, Masood made a false claim on Twitter that Pakistani Air Force planes are involved and they had shot down a Pakistani F-16. And he then put a picture out of an F-16 plane that was lying on the ground, completely intact. And in fact, Google Doc actually did a fact check, and they found out that this was an American F-16 that had crash landed near the border between Arizona and California back in April of 2016. It had nothing to do with a Pakistani Air Force plane. This was an American plane that had crash landed in the US during exercises, number one. Secondly, the Indians then came up with another fantastic claim. They said, oh, these Pakistani drones are carrying out operations and bombing in Panjshir Valley. And what they had done was they had taken a clip out of a video game called Armo 3. So they took a clip out of that video game. And again, that was so easily refuted. Boom, an internet service. They basically did a fact check and found out that was taken from a video game.
But is that there, Zafar, I think I would have to ask you or put the point that when people are doing state propaganda, they really don't care about the truth in the sense that they know that a broad-based lie will be what will be remembered, because they're not going to print the refutation.
Exactly. You see, what has happened is that the Indians are in total hysterics because they have lost so massively in Afghanistan. They had aligned themselves with the US-backed regime in Afghanistan. They had thought that that regime would last, that the Americans probably would never leave. And even if the Americans left, that their influence would be such that the Taliban at least would never come to power. So the Indians became the victims of American and their own propaganda, and they never realized that a day would come when the Taliban would be taking over. So now the Indians are in total hysteria. Their media in particular, their government has remained largely silent because they have lost so badly that they are embarrassed. They cannot come forward to say, well, we have lost completely. But the media cannot reconcile themselves to the fact that the Taliban have taken over and that India has lost both economically as well as politically, because India was using Afghanistan as a base from which it was carrying out terrorist operations against Pakistan from Afghanistan. And of course, now we see that those terrorist operations have stopped completely now that Indian intelligence agents have all fled Afghanistan. So this is clear proof that it was India that was backing these terrorists in their operations against Pakistan. So the Indian hysteria is actually understandable today.
Again, we're speaking to Zafar Benghash, and which, of course, the new developments in Afghanistan. Zafar, it seems almost like a political earthquake has happened in that region. There's a lot of turbulence and uncertainty. What about this matter? Tell us, I think many people are surprised to learn that the airport has been reopened. Kabul is already functioning again. Airlines are beginning to, I think Pakistan is the first official airline to come in and out of Kabul. But is it's Qatar and Turkey are playing a role there. Can you explain that? Talk about that.
Yes, of course. Qatar definitely has played a very sensible role, I must say, despite the fact that it's a tiny country, but it had maintained Taliban offices as far back as 2013 in its capital city and was acting as a go-between in negotiations with the United States. But the Taliban have a good working relationship with Qatar. They allowed the Qataris as well as the Turks to come and repair the airport that regrettably the Americans had actually vandalized in terms of not only military equipment, but also airport equipment. The control tower and other facilities and the runway had been damaged by the Americans before they left. It's such a sad state of affairs, and the whole airport was in a mess. So the Qataris and the Turks came, and they have basically, maintained everything, and now they have opened the airport. And as you said, Pakistan was the first commercial airline to fly in. It flew a flight into Kabul today, and I think these will continue as the airport becomes more and more functional. So I think it's beneficial for Afghanistan. They want to keep the airport open, and they want to make sure that other commercial airlines can also come into Kabul to bring humanitarian aid and to bring passengers and take passengers out. Yes.
Well, I think that's a good note to close on. Zafar, thank you very much. It's clear that there are so many more things to talk about. We look forward to speaking to you again very shortly.
It's my great pleasure, Phil. Thank you.
Thank you, Zafar Benghash. This is Taylor Report, CIUT, and we have more programming coming.